Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 55 for August 7, 2009. I'm recording the opening here right by the water so that you can get a little bit of the sound of the surf. We're here in Maine for the month of August, settling in. This sound, which we can hear from the cottage 24 hours a day, is something I really cherish about the place. It's constant, it never changes, and it's a bit like the soundtrack of my life because I've been coming here for so long, ever since I was in single digits.
My interview this week is with Nicholson Baker, the author of an article in The New Yorker, which has generated a lot of comment and some controversy. It's about the Kindle. It's his personal impressions of the Kindle, titled, A New Page, Can the Kindle Really Improve on the Book? If you haven't read the article yet, you might want to check it out before listening to our conversation. It goes longer than usual, but I think it provides some pretty interesting background information on why Baker wrote the article and what he's learned about the Kindle and the Kindle community since it was published. In news, Rupert Murdoch gets more money from Amazon but keeps on whining, and Sony announces two new readers available by the end of August. For this week's tech tip, I'll remind you how to use Zoolert.com to set up your own price trackers for Kindle comment on Amazon, and I'll share a very satisfying success story from my own experience with Zoolert. In content, I'll highlight a new series of classics for the classroom on the Kindle, and I'll note the new Kindle availability of a classic translation of Dante's Divine Comedy, supposedly optimized for the DX. As always, I'll close with your comments this week, including a question about PDFs, a clever tip on backups for non-Amazon Kindle content, a follow-up observation on Mike Elgin's interview, a library story, and far-flung shout-outs from Singapore and Fairbanks, Alaska. You can subscribe to this podcast at the iTunes and Zune stores or by going to the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. With that, let's turn to the news. Rupert Murdoch is still talking tough about a possible break with Amazon over the Wall Street Journal's Kindle edition, despite a price renegotiation that saw the monthly Kindle subscription cost rise from $10 to $15 with a bigger share for News Corp. That was in May. In a fiscal year-end earnings call with analysts this week, Murdoch said in response to a question by Stacey D. Kramer of paidcontent.org, quote, "We are changing the price of the journal on the Kindle and will get a better share of revenue, although I can't say that I'm satisfied that it's the final result that we want, but it'll be a lot better. It's not a big number and we're not encouraging it at all because we don't get the names of the subscribers. Kindle keeps them as their subscribers, not as ours, and I think eventually that will cause a break between us." One thing that this writer, Stacey Kramer, pointed out is that Murdoch, in the recent past in May, was touting how well the Wall Street Journal's free app was doing at the iTunes store. And she apparently asked, well, how come you can be complaining about the share of money you're getting from Amazon when you're getting nothing from Apple? And he basically said that they're going to be talking to Apple about that. He also was quoted as saying, "We're in active discussions with them," meaning Sony, "and they certainly accept that subscribers would be our subscribers." Murdoch, as Stacey points out, he appears to be negotiating in public, which he's done in the past, and she says it's sort of like Paula Abdul tweeting her resignation from American Idol. There's just not as much money at stake yet. Also in the news this week, Sony on August 4th announced two new readers that will be in stores by the end of this month. An item in PC World talks about the two readers. The Sony Reader Touch Edition comes with a 6-inch touchscreen, good for navigating the software menu, turning pages on ebooks, highlighting text, and more. That model is going to cost $299, which puts it at exactly the same price as the Kindle 2. They're also coming out with something called the Reader Pocket Edition, a more basic, smaller screen, a 5-inch screen, and that's going to cost only $199. So that's at the new low price point compared with the Kindles. They don't have as much storage as the Kindles. They hold up to 350 books. And the big thing which they still don't have is the wireless ability to load content directly to the unit. For this week's tech tip, I want to report back on my own experience with Zoolert.com. That's Zoolert.com. When I passed along Yisrael's Parker's tip about Zoolert on April 17th in episode 39, I set up an alert for a book that I really wanted to read, Power Rules by Leslie Gelb. And at the time, the price was listed at Amazon at what I considered to be an unconscionable $15.39, way above the $9.99 price that Ian Fried has said is really what they look for in new releases, and obviously for New York Times bestsellers. So I set the tracker on Zoolert to alert me if the price fell to $9.99, and then I stubbornly resisted the temptation to buy the book at the higher price, even though I really did want to read it. I figured I would play my small part in putting pressure on Amazon and the publishers to honor the $9.99 price for new releases. I didn't really expect the price to fall, but lo and behold, 4 days ago, on August 3rd, I saw an email in my inbox titled Price Match Alert. It read, "Hello, Len Edgerly. Your tracking price is equal or less than current price. Click the link below, and it'll bring you to the item Power Rules." So when I checked on that link, it showed, also the email said, note, price can change in a matter of minutes or seconds, maybe a price mistake by vendors, so they're urging me to jump right on it, which I did. So when I went to the link, there was a green flashing notice under the status column that read price matched. I clicked on the title link, and that brought me to the Amazon page where, sure enough, the price for that book had suddenly become $9.99. There's a price history that the Zoolert tracker page offers, and there I can see a table showing the $15.39 price holding until August 4th, and then there's a line graph showing a straight horizontal line at $15.39 and then a gratifying plunge down to $9.99. During those 4 months, the Zoolert tracker was checking Amazon's price of the book every 5 minutes. I noticed, by the way, that Power Rules had been tagged 18 times with either $9.99 boycott with the second 99 and boycott without a space, or 9 space 99 space boycott, a couple of tags that people have been using to put pressure on books that have the prices over $9.99. So it might be that these types of tools that we can wield as customers really do bring some results. So now that I'm a true believer in Zoolert, I want to walk you through the process for setting up your own price tracker. And this is what you do. Go to Zoolert.com. That's Zoolert.com. Click on the Kindle Mart tab in the orange horizontal menu bar. Search for the book that you want to track by title, author, or other means. Now, hopefully Zoolert will find the book on Amazon, but I have to say that a couple of titles that I tried recently for this podcast didn't show up as trackable under Zoolert, and I couldn't figure out exactly why that was, but you may have that experience. But hopefully the book that you're looking for will show up as available to track under Zoolert, and at that point you want to list the price that you're willing to pay. $9.99, I think, is a good one to shoot for. You leave the $9.99 as the target price for the Kindle edition, and then there are also spaces for third-party sources, sort of non-Kindle books, which you can just leave empty. You enter your email where you want Zoolert to send you a message when your target price shows up, and there's also a verification image to type, and then click Add Product to My Tracker. Then just sit back and wait. Promise yourself you're not going to buy the book until the price falls to $9.99, and with any luck, you'll get an email someday stating that your book's price has fallen to your target. That's the tech tip this week, and thanks to Yisrael Parker for originally pointing me towards Zoolert back in that earlier show. I spoke by telephone on August 4th with Nicholson Baker, who really shook things up in the Kindle sphere last week with his mainly negative personal impressions of the Kindle, published in The New Yorker. If I was expecting a hostile Luddite gleefully bashing our beloved Kindle, that's not at all what I heard in my headphones during our Skype call. I won't characterize Nick's comments in advance because I'm curious what your take will be on this conversation, which I reluctantly brought to a close only after reaching the 47-minute mark. Baker lives in southern Maine, not far from our place here at Ocean Park, and he began by talking about what he had been listening to Tuesday afternoon in the car on a return trip to South Berwick.
As I was driving home, I listened to a couple of your podcasts. I really, what a great thing you're doing. I mean, it's really good. It's really good stuff, and it's a good way to understand this very complicated product. So I,
well, thank you.
I just learned a lot.
Yeah. What did anything? Do you remember which episodes you listened to? Or
well, I listened to one with Stephen Wynn Walker, one with a woman named Aldous. She has her own.
Oh, Andra Spaston.
Yeah, and uh-huh. She was very, very knowledgeable, as you said. And I listened to some of Pam McCarthy's interview, all the tech tips, and also all the commentary from the people, which you rightly solicit and comes in and is informed. And, you know, you're willing to think all this stuff through. And I loved your Q&A with your wife. I thought was great when you got the DX. Yeah. And we're saying, well, this, but that, and this, that. And she said, well, I mean, I think you're being a little hard on it. I thought that was great.
That's true. She's my toughest interview whenever I have her on the show.
Well, anyway, it's nice work, and it's really a pleasure to listen to it.
Well, that's
great. And the sound quality is good too.
Well, I keep working on that, and that's really important. And my wife points that out whenever there's a glitch in the sound quality.
Well, I have to say, I didn't hear many. I mean, I was listening in the car, and I don't have a fancy car, so there was a lot of car noise. So maybe there was some hidden, very subtle something, but I honestly, I thought it sounded super professional.
Oh, that's great. I really appreciate that. Well, I thought one thing that would be interesting for my listeners might be a little background on how you came to write the piece and then basically just have a conversation with you about it. There were so many issues that you addressed that I think people would be fascinated to learn more about.
Sure.
But can you say whether you queried the New Yorker to propose the piece, or did someone at the New Yorker request you to write it? What was sort of the genesis of it?
Well, I was I wanted to take a look at the Kindle One. I've been looking at e-readers since the Rocket Book, way back when, and I bought this thing called the Library of the Future on CD-ROM back in, I guess it was 1995. And, you know, the idea of putting lots of books in a small space and having them be searchable and everything is interesting to me, and I've written about it in different ways. So, but I read the Kindle One, and the design of it seemed so odd that I thought that it would become entirely a review about the aesthetic choices that the designers made.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of put it in the back of my mind. And then the Kindle 2 came out, and I, the way it worked was my agent got in touch with the New Yorker and said, any interest in having Baker do a piece on this? And so then I had a talk with the editor, and he said, go ahead. And so I by that time had already ordered the Kindle 2. This was back in April.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote it the last week of April and sent it in. I guess I sent the draft in on the first week of May or so.
Mm-hmm. So, that was, I'm trying to remember when the DX came out. You finished it sort of as the DX was being announced?
But it wasn't, nobody had really seen it, and I did that in that draft. If you want to know how, see, I really don't like saying bad things about, I don't like bad book reviews. I mean, sometimes books are bad, you know, and I just feel that for the most part, what you should do is not give space to things that you don't like. Mm-hmm. So I really expected to like this product a little bit more than I went through this sort of, I mean, I don't want to make too much of a dramatic thing about it, but it was a moment of real, of, you know, in a because I think celebrations are better to read than denunciations. But then I discovered that you could look up books, you could read books on the iPod Touch / iPhone, and my son happened to know how to use the thing. I'd never even touched one, and we went to Target and bought it, and that it gave me a way out, in a sense, because I liked the hardware better, and the fact that Amazon is good at selling things stays true.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, and then in the end, I of the piece, I think it's true that if you're in the midst of a really engrossing reading experience, the thing in front of you, the page, the screen, the Visplex screen, whatever it is, falls away, and that is the miracle of books, and that continues. So, so that's how I came to write it. I bought the thing. I was fascinated by the real enthusiasm, and I like that. I mean, I like the fact that there is a whole community of people around this machine who are trying to understand all of its quirks and finding its lovable qualities and enjoying books on it, and I know I feel kind of cringy about the fact that I had to say things that were... What was I supposed to do? I mean, I guess I was supposed to... I just couldn't pretend is the problem. But I don't mean to say that if you or anybody else really likes reading books this way, that you should stop, because God knows there are a thousand different ways to read, just as there are all different ways to do any kind of complicated human activity. And some people like the Kindle more than anything else, and I don't want to stand in their way.
Hmm. You said the other day that you thought maybe some people had been offended or hurt by the article. How quickly after it came out did you start having that sense that there had been that kind of reaction to it in some quarters?
Well, I mean, I don't know what article I wrote, and I did say rather harsh things about it, so it wasn't as if I was surprised by the reaction at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I don't want to be taken as saying that there is only one way to read, and that way is with the physical book in your hand, and it's got to smell a certain way, and you've got to be sitting in a wooden chair, and, you know, it isn't like that. Sometimes you're on a plane, sometimes you're in the subway, and sometimes you want to have a stack of books taking up space in a bookshelf, and there are all hundreds of different reasons for why you would want to own a reading machine.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to like this reading machine more than I did, and I, to be true to my own experience of it, which is, after all, what I was supposed to be doing,
yeah.
I had to be clear about that.
Now, after you finished the article, did you continue reading it all on the Kindle, or it was just something that you didn't really want to do any more reading on it?
Well, I finished writing the article, as I said. I guess it was sometime in May, and then there, as you know, the New Yorker has an awful lot of good writing queued up, and so there's some time between when an article is submitted and when it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
So I then read, I bought a DX, and read it, and we bought some more things for the Kindle, I guess, and then I subscribed to the Times,
mm-hmm.
and compared it against the print version of the Times. So there was another sustained burst of reading. What can I tell you, Lynn? I mean, I in a sense, doing this piece has changed my life. There's no question, because I do. And I don't know that this is the right, that this is what you would want me to say, but reading the iPod Touch at night is a really nifty way to read things, I think. And I do that now.
I see. So you've continued reading on the Touch. And
right.
So
now,
this sort of changed your life by introducing you to a new way of reading, but not the one you expected.
Yeah, and I mean, life is like that, isn't it? You think, well, okay, I'll embrace this thing, but then you carry them off that into a different direction. And Amazon is still doing okay by me because some of those books I bought via the Kindle store, and you know they've already sold me a piece of hardware. But really, I think that the interest of the, and I'm not an Apple guy. I mean, I have a PC, and it's not as if I'm a tremendous fanatic of the Apple from way back at all. But it just, there are a couple of other apps on the iPod Touch that are really lovely. I mean, this eucalyptus, what I like about it is it's one guy, this guy who's in Scotland, and he spent a year doing this software, and he took Gutenberg books that are public domain, and they have this really nice, undulant way of turning the page, but also he just, it's well-designed. And I've discovered books that I didn't know about that way, and that's what I end up reading more than anything else.
So are you reading the Touch not just at night, but like curled up in your favorite chair during the day and reading for an hour or so the way you might have a print book before?
No, but then right now I'm not reading that much. I'm sure you've done writing, and you know that when you're doing research for something, it's basically you're hauling in things from every direction. You're going to the library, you're looking through bits of books, finding things on the web, copying articles, getting stuff from JSTOR, you know, and also interviewing people. So, but at night, the nice thing is that the world kind of narrows down to a single thread, and it's nice if words can kind of slip in along that thread. Yeah. I'll tell you what my first, I don't want to say disappointment, my first query about the Kindle was that I ordered it, and I ordered a clip-on light, you know.
Uh-huh.
Because I obviously, this is one of the things I knew that I really wanted. I had a problem in my life, which is I don't want to turn on the light and wake up my wife. You know, this is not an unfamiliar problem for a lot of people. And so I bought the clip-on light. Well, the clip-on light is just doesn't clip on very well on the Kindle too. I don't know if you've tried it, but
yeah, I've got it. I have to clip it sort of to the leather cover that I took, but it is awkward.
It's awkward, and it's not a solution to the problem if you're going to lie there in bed with this thing that keeps plopping off. So I thought, okay, my initial hope has been, you know, put on hold here. So that's I tried to be fair about this because. The piece has to be about my own subjective reaction, and people should just accept it, just take that as a given, that this is not necessarily going to be their reactions at all.
Mm-hmm.
But if this thing was a white screen with black letters on it, and it was lean, mean, and fast, so that you could really page around the way you can page around in a photocopy. Mm-hmm. You know, you print off something in your computer, that 8-page scientific article, whatever it is, and you can flip around. You could really digest that thing. If this offered that, I wouldn't be troubled by the fact that there was no color or that there were the other things that some people complain about. But it just seems to me that it was like working with molasses to get around a book. And that would, the first and primary requirement of an e-reader would be to really be able to move around a book, to flip around a book, to get to page 80 or the equivalent thereof, and then back to 40 and then to 43, and really, and that hasn't been solved on the Kindle. Not that it won't be in the future, but it's actually easier for me to get around a PDF file using not Adobe Acrobat Reader, but one of the other, what is it? Is it eSlick? I don't know. There's a couple of you know, quicker moving
for
Acrobat
PDFs,
readers.
Yeah, you know, one thing I was reading Double Fold the last couple of days on my Kindle. And I was struck by a similarity, it seemed, between how you were describing your reaction to microfilm and reading on the Kindle. And the one that struck me the most was at one point you talk about the gray-green screen of the microfilm. And then when you talk about the Kindle, you say it wasn't just gray, it was greenish, sickly gray. Were you aware of any kind of a link between the distaste, you know, certainly understandable, almost horror that you developed in working on that book toward microfilm and what you saw when you first turned on the Kindle?
Well, I think that's a very interesting parallel you draw. I mean, it could be, I suppose you could say that I was permanently damaged by, but no, you know, microfilm also has its place, and there's nothing wrong with taking pictures of things. It was just the problem there in that book was that people were saying, this is the greatest thing. We must do it. There's an emergency. All books are disintegrating, and therefore they all must be copied, and we all are going to read books this way. And then you look at the screen, and it is this really unpleasant reading experience. It's not as good as the experience that, you know, we've had for centuries. So, and paralleling that is this announcement on the part of many people in the media that the Kindle is the new millennium, and that people will read in an entirely different way. And it's a revolution. Not only that, but textbooks are going to have to be read this way, and people in colleges are going to have to use their course materials this way. And this is the big changing thing. And it just, I'm wary of that, because it seems to me that there's never, if you try to push things down one pipe before they are naturally willing to go down that pipe, the life of the mind suffers a little bit. And I don't think, and I think that Amazon, which is, you know, a really interesting, complicated company with many good things about it, pushed this thing out before it was really ready as a piece of hardware. That would be my assessment of it. But they also were very successful in creating enthusiasm. I mean, the thing that all these Kindle people are feeling is a real feeling. It's, we are part of a community, and we are reading a different way, and we're discovering books a different way, and we're reducing clutter. That's all exciting, and Amazon has to be credited for creating that emotion. But the actual piece of hardware, and this is also, I have to just say, also, that it isn't entirely that this is Amazon's machine, because this is a machine built around a technology that, of course, Sony brought to market first. This e-screen, this Visplex stuff. I think that's the fundamental mistake. I think that that they'd embraced something that is really scientifically interesting, these little microspheres that go up and down, but is not ready to do what paper and ink does very well.
And the other parallel that sort of followed it was when I was reading about your descriptions of Werner Klapp, and then thinking about how Jeff Bezos seems to strike you as, you know, really pushing the Kindle in a strong way. And there's a quote where you talk about Clapp and you say, why couldn't he have left library administrators alone rather than forever distracting them from their primary task as paper keepers by dangling the lure of convulsive change before them long before the change was practical and long before it had revealed its many risks? And I wondered if you sort of have that same feeling about Bezos, that he is, you know, dangling the lure of convulsive change regarding e-readers, and it's just sort of coming on too strong too soon, given the dangers of that kind of situation that you uncovered in looking at microfilm.
Well, this is an interesting parallel. I would have to say Werner Clapp, and there's no comparison between Jeff Bezos and Werner Clapp. Bezos is a much smarter and much more capable guy. Mm-hmm. Werner Clapp, however, was a lifelong bureaucrat at the Library of Congress who had a good prose style and wanted libraries to shrink down and become photographic images of themselves. He wasn't a businessman, although he did get somewhat excited about the idea of selling microfilm copies of things to other libraries. But Bezos is a businessman, and his primary concern is to have things, is to own the pipeline, and to have and to be able to take his 30% or 50% or 60% of whatever transaction is happening. It may be a used book purchase, new book purchase, e-book. It might be the selling of a lawnmower, whatever it is. Everything, it just seems, is going in that direction. And when a really neat product like Stanza for the iPod comes up and does a better job than Kindle for iPhone, he buys the company, you know, because he's a businessman and wants to control competition to a degree, and of course that's what he does. And I mean, it's part of the fascination and brilliance of the guy, but it's also sometimes a little disturbing, you know, because he's so intent on this. And I just wish sometimes that a little company that has a success could have its moments of being a successful little company before some other big company pounces on it and swallows it up. I mean, the most troubling one for me is Amazon's purchase of Abe Books, which is the very wonderful used book.
I wasn't aware of that. I knew they bought Audible, but what's the one that you're talking about that they bought a used book?
AbeBooks.com. They give you they have a lot of different used booksellers, and they just recently bought. An earlier, I can't remember, I think it's Book Finder. Anyway, they bought one of the earliest and best used book companies and kind of absorbed it, digested it, and used it. And now all new books have this competition of the used books that are for sale for a penny or $1.95 or whatever. And publishers don't like that. Mm-hmm. But Amazon likes it because in some cases they make more, a higher margin on some of the used books than the new books, depending. I mean, it's just fascinating about Amazon. It's so much to be said about it, and my article does a completely inadequate job of getting into any of that. But because Kindle is, and you can help me with this, I mean, in all the Amazon promotional things, they call it Kindle. They don't use the Kindle. Mm-hmm. But everybody who's talking about it always refers to it as the Kindle, and it's sort of like the product marketers wanted it to be called Kindle without the. Do you know anything?
I don't know. I've sort of wondered, you know, in my own usage of it. I always talked about the Kindle, but I have heard it used more without the article. So I don't really know what's going on there. I don't really like the sound of it, but it feels like that's the usage which seems to be dominating.
Yeah. Well, in any case, the Kindle or Kindle is just one part of a very complicated thing. And I know that Amazon says that it's, you know, 30% or something of all book sales that are available on. But you know, another thing that would help a lot with all these kinds of discussions and exchanges would be if Amazon would actually be a little more forthcoming with information, I mean, sales figures, you know, and so it wasn't just that a source close to Amazon said that 300,000 copies of, Kindles had sold, but that they actually released some hard numbers. I mean, this is an incredibly secretive company, and so nobody can make, I think nobody can make decisions that are based on real information, because they just sort of tease it. They release these teasers, and these are big decisions that people are making.
Yeah, it's there's been a whole sort of industry grown up on trying to figure out how many they've sold. It seems like they've, most of the estimates I've seen make me think that they've passed the 1 million mark in terms of sales. But it's
right, and I think that's including the Kindle One and Kindle Two together and DX.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that seems like a fair, but it would be nice to know. And also, what you want to know about the percentage of e-books versus regular books is, or I shouldn't say regular books, because what is a regular book these days? E-books versus print books, print-on-paper books, is that Amazon has lots of books that are sold for, you know, $1.95, and some are sold for free.
Yeah.
But they're called sales. So are they saying that those sales are including the free sales, or are they saying only books that are sold for,
good point.
Just don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot we don't know. We have to depend on what they tell us.
Yeah.
There's one thing that in your chat that you did at the New Yorker site, and someone asked you about Sven Burkert's, I think he'd had something in The Atlantic, and you talked about that homing in feeling of just a single hovering page of words can be good, turns everything into a little poem. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I've talked a lot about on the podcast, and as you know, as a writer, I've thought about, because I've had this sense that when I am looking at a much smaller field of words, that my mind is engaging with the text in a, somehow it seems like a more attentive way, a more zen-like way, and that it actually is putting more emphasis on the words that the author wrote as opposed to the packaging, the print, the whatever. And so sometimes I've been surprised that authors who, you know, when an author writes something, the only thing the author controls are sort of what you said at some point, the string of words, or other people have talked about the right words in the right order. That's what the author controls.
Right.
And on these ebooks, whether it's the Kindle or the others, it sometimes seems to me that I'm more connected with that aspect of the book, the right words in the right order. And so but did you have that sense that in any of your reading, or maybe you're picking that up on the touch, that the way the words are coming into your mind is actually different because you're having so few of them at a time compared to reading on a page?
Yeah, I did feel that. I do feel that much more, with the iPod Touch at night, with the screen turned very dim and the screen black with words somewhat faint, so that you're just getting the verbal representation of a single voice talking to you, an intelligent voice, and you kind of it's narrowed down, it's beautiful, it's exciting. I don't get that quite as much with the Kindle, because I think that that it was designed by people who were less attuned maybe to typography than they should have been. I think that the choice of the typeface, I guess it's Cecilia, is that how you, but is just not, wasn't a good choice. I mean, I'm in a minority with all these things. I mean, and one of the reasons that I felt that I had some license to say things that were critical is that I'm obviously not a I'm not the voice of the majority here. I'm just, there are thousands and thousands of, I don't know how many messages now on the Kindle, how many 5-star reviews are there, but they're innumerable. They're enormous, and it's just completely.
Yeah, so they outnumber the 1-stars by more than 4-1. I think the latest reading I saw was there were 3,195 5-star reviews and only 746 1-stars. So yeah, okay. It's overwhelming the people that are actually using it and how they rate it.
Right, and people love it, and I tried to be true to that. It's not just that they love it because, you know, there is, somebody has a theory about erotic romance novels and romance novels. It's not just that. It's obviously exciting a whole bunch of people. I'm in part of a small minority of people, but it's sometimes useful to have the minority view set down on paper thoroughly. And it's not that I think that Amazon should stop selling the Kindle. Obviously, I mean, this was the set of choices that they made, and this is the design they came up with. But I do think it's worth putting it down because, you know, colleges are deciding right now whether they are going to really ask students to try to learn stuff and, I don't know, take notes from course materials that are on the Kindle DX, and I think that the colleges that are doing that should be able to make an informed decision.
Yeah. I think one concern I've seen, and I heard from one listener who wrote a really nice email to me talking about the books in his dining room in his apartment in Manhattan, and he said that behind the books he had squirreled away both of his Newtons, that Apple Newton PDA, and he said, "I love my Newton. The Newton was a brilliant device and did an enormous number of amazing things." But then he talked about, and I didn't remember this, but he said, "But from the moment when the otherwise admirable Gary Trudeau lampooned it in Doonesbury, the Newton was doomed. I frankly live in fear that some anti-Kindleite will find a way to spin a flaw or limitation so as to capture the zeitgeist and, quote, do a Newton on the Kindle. I don't think Baker's article is that, but it comes closer than most." And, you know, and I think my own concern was knowing that, what is the New Yorker's got a subscriptions of like 10 million people, right? This is a correction. Actually, the New Yorker circulation is about 1 million, not 10 million. We'll return now to the interview. It's a pretty strong forum for, as you say, a fairly contrarian take on the Kindle to be put out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the New Yorker, really, I just do want to say that there's no way that the editors of the New Yorker knew what my article was going to be ahead of time. They just thought, well, he's written about bookish things in the past, and we, you know, so yeah. they, and to their credit, I mean, I think they published the piece without any interest in swaying me in any direction or anything like that. They just and probably at some maybe cost of Kindle subscriptions. I don't know, but
I don't know. Yeah, because the Kindle's the New Yorker's the biggest selling publication on the Kindle. So,
I guess it was for me. When I looked recently, it seemed to be The Economist. But yes, they were number one for a good long time.
Yeah.
I don't know. The thing about the Newton was, well, you know, this is what puzzles me is, you know, the Newton was really doing a bunch of things that were, it was trying to do things that were almost impossible to do at the time, given the size and the state of electrical engineering and all that. But I look at the Kindle and I think that it takes me back in time. I mean, that's my, and maybe that's part of, I think, the excitement of it for people is that it is sort of, it's sort of intrinsically, and I mean this without any, it's intrinsically a little retro. I mean, it's just, it's this gray on gray thing. It's like, it's a little like an old-fashioned TV, you know, a black and white TV. I mean, in some ways, that's part of the pleasure of it, is that it's not, it doesn't have the Apple's luminous, jewel-like quality, I guess. But it just, the difference is that, well, first of all, I don't remember Gary Trudeau's lambasting.
No, I don't either.
But I don't mean to, you know, kind of, as I say, I think that the Kindle has so many supporters that it's not as if I'm going to destabilize it or anything. But the Kindle is doing something, to me, that this is just my opinion, less well than an LCD has been able to do for years now. I mean, and it's not even as if the iPod Touch is at the extreme edge of resolution. Epson is working on LCD screens with, I think, they're 500 pixels per inch. I mean, this is something we can now put images on screens that are incredibly fine and have a very, very high refresh rate, a very fast flicker rate. And this is where I think the only real, you know, interesting point or the only contribution that I feel I can make as technically to all this messy debate is to say that maybe it was a mistake to think that we must have a reflective surface. It must be like a piece of paper that stuff bounces off, that an emissive surface, a surface that has light coming from behind it, is intrinsically bad. Maybe that was a mistake because it forced this new invention of Visplex that now has to go through a whole very expensive evolution in order to get it up to speed, in order to get it to move quickly. And
I think, and you know, for me, that was one of the most significant points that you made. And I have to say, I totally disagreed with it based on my own experience, because I spend most of my day looking at a computer screen, you know, a nice bright Apple and I've got an iPhone and I've been reading on stands and all this. And I have this sense of ease to my eyes that comes over me when I put my Kindle up in front of a nice bright light in my next to my leather chair, and I do read for, you know, hours on end on the Kindle without ever having any of the kind of fatigue that seems to take me over when I'm looking at either the iPhone or the computer.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah,
and I don't, you know, one thing I'd be really curious to see, there's got to be some research coming on various aspects of the Kindle and the e-ink screens, but someone's got to be able to measure some symptoms of eye strain or whatever on a backlit screen versus the reflective. And I think that for me, the magic of the Kindle is the combination of it feels to my eyes and almost my mind that I'm looking at a page because of the reflective. It like you say, it feels sort of retro. I'm leaving my computer now. I'm going back into my leather chair with this thing that reminds me of paper. But if I see, you know, someone mention a book, I can have that book on the thing in 60 seconds. And I can see the little dictionary, synonym at the bottom. And all of these things that... and if I get tired, I don't have to just leave the book. I can switch to reading The New Yorker or The Economist or a love story or something. And so to me, it's this weird combination of the fact it is retro, but it does all of these gee whiz things.
Yeah. Well, right. I see that. But I would make a distinction, and a very, very huge distinction, between the computer screen that you look at and the handheld LCD screen, the iPod screen, because, for one thing, handheld screens, and they've done a number of studies on this, when you hold something like a Kindle or like an iPod Touch or a tablet, you're constantly fixing the glare problem and adjusting it so that your eyes are at the right kind of angle in the orbits of your eyes, so that everything is more comfortable.
Well, because you can move it so easily.
Right. A static screen. I interviewed Mary Lou Jepsen, who did the Pixel Qi, who's doing this fascinating screen that's a hybrid between, right, you know, the Visplex and or anyway, mm-hmm, a really interesting, brilliant screen designer, and she talked about studies that and forwarded me one about the difference between static and holdable.
Oh.
So there's that, but the other thing though is, and anyone who's done any proofing knows this, that you can write for 3 solid days writing your essay on something or other, and then you think, okay, I'm gonna send it off to the magazine, and then you think a little bird in you chirps and says, don't do it yet, print it out and read it,
uh-huh,
because the resolution level on the page is high enough that your eyes snag on typos in a different way. And anyone who's done any proofing in any kind of production environment knows that there's a much higher error rate of things that you miss on a screen.
Interesting.
But what is the difference between the screen and the screen that you're looking at on an Apple computer, a laptop, is you're talking about the neighborhood of 100 pixels per inch density, right, on a PC screen, and on the iPod Touch, you're talking about 163, which is a huge difference. I mean, so what you've got, a handheld device that is also higher resolution. So I just don't. That's where I can't go along with you and say that, because I get some of the same reposeful feelings. In fact, I fall asleep. What does that mean? I fall asleep reading the iPod.
Well, I had one of my listeners said that maybe the reason he's falling asleep is that the eye strain is getting to him.
Yeah, maybe that's
it's lulling him to sleep.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not a falling asleep. I mean, it's not an eye strain kind of falling asleep. I just think that the direction that we're going in, and it's not as if this is going to replace the book or anything, because I don't think one technology does replace other technologies quite
right.
This way. But we're going towards, I think what we're going towards is higher resolution screens, but more traditional screens, unless Visplex can get a lot better, a lot quicker, and we won't know that until some of these other devices come out. When I wrote the piece, the iTablet, so-called, was just a rumor, so I didn't include it. In fact, I cut out the part of it that was about that, because I'm very curious to see whether some of those uses of what's now actually very familiar technology of liquid crystals, it may actually outstrip the kinds of things that the engineers can do with Visplex. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the fun of all this is that we don't know, and it's really complicated. And the part that's less fun is that a person like me comes along and says, well, gosh, especially the DX just seems to me to be a mistake. I mean, just straight down the line mistake. It's heavy. The keyboard is really strange. I mean, this is something you're paying $489 for a keyboard that is artfully ridiculous. I mean, it's a person who was thinking about how it would, something that would be striking to look at would be really, but wouldn't be something that your thumbs wanted to mess with in an efficient way. And I just think that that's a bit much for Apple to be then pushing that as something that colleges should embrace as the replacement for.
You mean Amazon?
I'm sorry, that Amazon shouldn't be, but pushing that to replace course packs, and especially textbooks, you know.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out. I've been surprised at how well the DX appears to be selling. I mean, they can't keep them in stock. So yeah. I was trying to get an interview. Somebody from the Princeton Project left a comment for you in the chat on the New Yorker. So I emailed him to try to get him on the podcast, but he deferred to the whatever publicity they're going to do at Princeton later. But we're going right. It's going to be pretty fun to see how those five universities handle this and what they learn from it. But I agree, you know, to me the weight of it and the keyboard are really problems with the DX, and some of the other things are good. Well, we've probably reached our time, Nick. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you. I'll have to confess that when I first read the piece, I was in the maybe the offended and the hurt category, but I've read it since then about three times, and I think that, and in a lot of the comments I've seen on the internet, even people who are tremendous Kindle fans have appreciated the art of your writing about it, even as you were sort of eviscerating our love. But, phrases like, I mean, the one that I saw over and over that I think is now launched in the language is when you talk about an Alpenhorn blast of post-Gutenbergian revalorization. You know, I mean, this has not been seen in the normal comments on the blogs about the Kindle. So you really sort of put everything up a notch. And I think that, you know, a million people out there, and the thing is well launched enough that I don't think you're gonna have to worry that if the Kindle craters from here that you single-handedly shot it from the sky.
No, and I think, and I've learned a great deal from the comments. I mean, I knew that there would be unhappy comments, but I think there's so many thoughtful people out there who like this machine in different ways and have really given this thought. So I have learned a lot from writing the piece, which is one of the reasons you write something. You write it, you do your best to tell the truth and say it the way you want to say it, and then, you know, you then learn from what people say how you might have said it differently.
Yeah, that's so. Right. That's the benefit of it.
Turning now to content, I received notice this week of 200 new textbook titles for the Kindle from a company named Shmoop. That's S-H-M as in Mary, O-O-P as in Peter, based in Mountain View, California. The total includes more than 50 titles in Shmoop Classics, described as the first series of mashups for Kindle to offer the full original text of classic literature, interwoven with smart, fun analysis. In addition, they have made more than 140 study guides available on the Kindle. The CEO of Shmoop, Ellen Simonoff, was quoted in a release as saying, "Kindle gives readers freedom to take their classroom on the road." I checked out a couple of the titles that they sent to me wirelessly, and I was intrigued by the combination of sound literary commentary and what appeared to this 58-year-old to be presentation in distinctly up-to-date idioms. And the material, the literary material, they say, is prepared by PhDs from Stanford, Harvard, and UC Berkeley mainly. So it's an interesting new offering in the textbook area, and I'll have a link in the show notes so you can go check it out if you'd like. I also saw on, this came from ereader-zone.com. There was a post announcing a recent arrival in the Kindle store of Dante's Divine Comedy as translated by John, I think that's Ciardi, C-I-A-R-D-I. And at Amazon, the title is $9.99, and it's flagged as optimized for Kindle DX. So I bought it, and I put it on my DX as well as my Kindle 2, and I honestly could not find a single item that was better or specially presented on the DX. But it's a good translation, and the line breaks certainly look better on the DX because there's just a wider screen to play with. And I imagine that would be true of most of poetry. And I'll have a link to that apparently recently released translation of the Divine Comedy on the show notes. And finally, your comments. Howard Dunleavy emailed with a couple of questions that he hoped I would help him with. I didn't have the answers, so I told him I'd put them out to you, the listeners, and see if someone might be able to give him some help. His first question was, do you have any software recommendations for creating a single publication, i.e. book, out of many individual PDF files? I have several books, he says, that came out over time in one chapter increments that I have as a PDF file. I would like to take those chapters and create a single book out of them. I have worked with Mobi Pocket, Calibre, and Auto Kindle eBook Converter. It seems like Mobi Pocket would be best suited to this, but I could not figure out how to create a single book for multiple files. Anyway, do you know what software would be best for this? Until PDFs are searchable on the DX, I need this kind of a solution. Secondly, he asked, do you know if you can plug any device that gets power from a USB port into the Kindle DX Electric plug-in, which takes the USB cable from the Kindle? I was thinking about using it to charge an iPod, but didn't know if that would damage the iPod or not. I was wary of this. I it seems to me like this could cause some troubles, but maybe someone out there knows if the plug that comes with the Kindle, that highly praised plug by Nicholson Baker in his piece, can be used for appliances and devices other than the Kindle. So if you have any answers to those, please email them to me at podchronicles@gmail.com, or if you want to send in an audio comment, you could also do that. I'll tell you at the end of the show how to send in an audio comment. Dave Hicks emailed, I was listening to this week's show where you talked about backing up a Project Gutenberg book that you had emailed to your Kindle. I just wanted to remind your listeners that if they send the email with the document they want added through a Gmail or similar account, they automatically back it up at the same time. All you have to do is go into Gmail and search for any mail sent to your Kindle account, and you will have a complete list and backup of anything you've ever added to your Kindle through the email mechanism. Hope some of your listeners find this useful. That's a brilliantly simple comment, and I use Gmail myself, and so it's good to know that even if I am putting something on my Kindle that didn't come from Amazon, so it's not in the Amazon cloud, there is this backup possibility by sending the file through Gmail. Tom Lichty of Portland, Oregon emailed, I enjoyed your interview with Mike Elgin a few weeks back. It's one that I'll probably listen to again. In his discussion of releasing books first electronically while the print versions wind their way through the publishing process, it brought to mind another reason for advanced electronic publishing, gatekeepers. It wouldn't surprise me to learn that many literary gatekeepers, reviewers and bloggers especially, would welcome advanced electronic editions. Among those gatekeepers, I include Kindle readers, who often influence more than their share of the literary market. I think that's absolutely true, and I have reviewed at least one book, I think, and the publisher was able to send it to me as a PDF file, and I loaded it to my Kindle, and it was certainly a lot easier to review the copy in advance by being able to read it on my Kindle. Alan McDermott in Bardstown, Kentucky emailed this response to the Nicholson Baker article in The New Yorker. I don't have an iPod Touch, so cannot comment on the readability on that device, but I will relate a recent event to highlight the opposite of what he is doing. I recently downloaded a sample of the first of the Jack Reacher series, Killing Floor by Lee Childs. By the end of the sample, I was hooked and wanted to continue the book. I had just gotten a new library card, so went to their card catalog, looked it up, and put a hold on that book. I waited several days for it to come in. When I got the notification via phone that it was there, I went to the library the next day and picked it up. It was a paperback, something I had not noticed in the card catalog. It was sort of falling apart. The binding was coming apart. It had been bound poorly so that the glue encroached on some of the text, and it was just too small a print to read for more than 30 minutes at a time. I gave up, bought the book from Amazon for $6.77, including the tax, and had it in a few minutes. I continued reading on the Kindle hours at a time in font size 5 or 6. It does not bother me that the paper is a light gray. It does not bother me that the black letters are not blacker than the print on my computer, which they call black. I just care that I can make the font big enough for these tired eyes of mine to read comfortably. Charles Tay emailed, "Hi, greetings from Singapore. I am a new Kindle 2 owner awaiting the arrival of my Kindle 2 from Amazon. I came across your podcast while browsing for Kindle-related articles, and since then I've listened to a few of your podcasts and will continue to listen to more. I've also got one audio comment this week from my friend Kes Woodward in Fairbanks, Alaska, who was my guest a month ago on episode 50.
Hi, Lynn. This is Kes. I loved hearing the congratulatory comments on the first anniversary of your podcast, and I was dismayed that since I was off in the wilds of first Denali Park and later the Copper River in Alaska, well beyond the reach of landlines or even cell phones, I hadn't been able to add my voice to the chorus. So I hope it's not too late to add my belated but heartfelt congratulations now. I have, as you know, listened to and enjoyed every minute of every Chronicles podcast long before I got a Kindle of my own. Thanks for encouraging me to come down this road, and thanks for all your great work, my friend. I can't wait to see what you come up with in year number two.
It's very good to hear your voice, Kes. Thanks for the message. And if you would like to leave an audio comment, it's easy to do. Just call 206-666-2713. I love getting audio comments from listeners that I can play on the show. It's best to keep them fairly short, like Kes did. 30 seconds to a minute is a good length. And if I don't know you, please say your name carefully and maybe even spell it out for me. I can edit that part out, but that way I'll be able to know who you are to introduce the audio comment. You can also email me at podchronicles@gmail.com or leave a comment on the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. There have been a lot of good comments on the show lately, so be sure to check out thekindlechronicles.com for other comments. If you'd like to be included in my Kindled Spirits email alert list, please drop me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. I send the people on that list an email the moment that I've uploaded a new episode, as well as occasional alerts on late-breaking news. And I've also turned to the Kindled Spirits for help sometimes in preparing for interviews, as I did this week with for my talk with Nicholson Baker. I could also use your help next week generating support for a panel that I've proposed to give at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. That's the big interactive conference March 12th through 21st held with a film and a music festival in Austin. The title of the workshop that I proposed is Taming the Kindle Guidance for Readers and Authors, and I've received a very favorable first response from the staff at the conference. But a big part of their decisions on who to invite to present rests on votes at their panel picker, and that is going to go live Monday, August 17th and close September 4th. The URL is sxsw.com/interactive, and then look for the panel picker. I'm really excited about the chance to present a Kindle panel in Austin, and it would help me out if you could go to the panel picker and spread the word so that we can generate some clicks that will help them to understand that this would be a topic that a fair number of people would be interested in. Thanks to Nicholson Baker for the bravely coming on the show. He knew he was coming into the lion's den of Kindle supporters after his article, and I thought he was very gracious and forthcoming about the background of the article and what he learned from it. So I hope you enjoyed the interview. I really enjoyed talking with him. Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Eval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording, courtesy of IODA PromoNet. This is Len Edgerly from Ocean Park, Maine, for the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.